Yeah, a lot of people think that I'm the unofficial mayor of Sachsenhausen. And so my friends, they say, yeah, he is. He is. He knows everybody. But no, this is a really great corner to live in. This is really the artist corner. There's a lot of artists here, writers here, musicians. So this is really nice.
Herzlich willkommen bei Global Village 069, dem Podcast, der die internationale Vielfalt von Frankfurt am Main zelebriert. Hier spreche ich mit Frankfurterinnen und Frankfurtern, die ihre Wurzeln in einem anderen Land haben und die aus der kleinen Metropole am Main einen der großartigsten Melting Pots überhaupt machen. Ich bin Marie Wendling, eingefleischte Globetrotterin und Wahlfrankfurterin. Schön, dass ihr hier seid. Gute und hello! Herzlich willkommen zu dieser Folge von Global Village 069, die Welt zu Hause in Frankfurt. Ich finde, es ist noch nicht zu spät, um euch ein frohes neues Jahr zu wünschen und passend zu dieser Episode zu sagen Happy New Year. Denn heute reisen wir in ein englischsprachiges Land, in Frankfurt. Und zwar in ein Land, zu dem unsere Stadt eine ganz besonders enge Beziehung hat. Die Rede ist von den Vereinigten Staaten von Amerika. Und wir haben heute auch eine Premiere. Das Interview wird nämlich auf Englisch stattfinden zum ersten Mal. Aber keine Sorge, die Zusammenfassung auf Deutsch, wie auch auf Englisch natürlich, und alle Verlinkungen gibt es wie immer in den Shownotes und auf globalvillage069.de. Und ab sofort findet ihr die Zusammenfassung dort mit den passenden Zeitmarkierungen. Dann findet ihr leichter die Stellen, die ihr im Gespräch sucht. Ja, der Einfluss US-amerikanischer Kultur ist natürlich in der ganzen westlichen Welt sehr stark. Aber hier in Frankfurt ist er das nochmal ganz besonders. In der letzten Folge mit Hassan Anouri zum Beispiel habe ich viel über den musikalischen Einfluss von amerikanischem Hip-Hop gesprochen. Und dass es hier so viele erstklassige Jazz-Venues gibt, ist sicherlich auch kein Zufall. Dann haben wir in Frankfurt mehrere richtig gute US-amerikanische Restaurants. Und ich meine hier nicht Mc's und KFC, ich meine hier richtige Restaurants. Dann haben wir US-Candy-Shops, wo es alles gibt, von Pop-Tarts und Reese's Erdnussbutter-Schokolade bis hin zu Marshmallow-Fluff mit Erdbeergeschmack. Yep, das gibt's wirklich. Und natürlich gibt es American Sports noch und nöcher hier. Wir haben mit Frankfurt Galaxy ein American Football Team, wir haben mit den Eagles ein Baseball Team und wir haben mehrere Basketball Teams hier in Frankfurt. An der Stelle für alle Basketballliebhaberinnen und Liebhaber ein Spezialtipp. Die Harlem Globetrotters kommen im April zu uns in die Stadt. Ja, und wir erinnern uns alle bestimmt noch an den letzten November, als die NFL hier am Main zu Gast war. Zu all diesen Punkten, zu Musik, Essen, Einkaufen und Sport, habe ich euch einige Tipps recherchiert und in den Shownotes und der Website zusammengestellt. Schaut hier also gerne einmal rein. Jetzt aber zu meinem Gast heute. Er ist jemand, der in einem ganz anderen Feld unterwegs ist. Er ist nämlich ein ganz wunderbarer Künstler, genauer gesagt Maler. Aber eigentlich ist er Lebenskünstler, denn er hat eine enorm abwechslungsreiche Lebensgeschichte und eine Art, mit Leichtigkeit und Kreativität durchs Leben zu gehen, dass es einfach Freude macht, ihm zuzuhören. Sein Name ist Jeffrey Carter. Jeffrey und ich haben uns in seiner Wohnung am Tag nach dem NFL-Spiel der Kansas City Chiefs letzten November getroffen. Und der Anlass für unser Gespräch war seine nächste Ausstellung. Die läuft vom 22. März bis zum 28. März in der Galerie Textor 74 auf der Textorstraße in Sachsenhausen. Auch hier teile ich natürlich die Links in den Shownotes und auf der Website. Wir sprechen aber über noch so viel mehr. Unter anderem darüber, wie er überhaupt zur Kunst kam. Wir sprechen über seine Zeit als Seriendarsteller in Hollywood und mit welchem Trick er es geschafft hat, an Castings zu kommen. Diese Story ist wirklich ultra lustig. Dann sprechen wir darüber, warum er mit 34 Jahren schließlich zur Armee ging und warum es ihm so wichtig war, als Leiter des Armee-Pressebüros in Afghanistan auch positive Geschichten zu erzählen. Und wir sprechen natürlich ganz viel über Frankfurt. Und zum Beispiel darüber, warum Jeffrey die Eintracht der NFL vorzieht, warum Washington D.C. ihn in Teilen an Driftebach erinnert und warum er der inoffizielle Bürgermeister von Sachsenhausen ist. Ja, wenn ihr zu dieser Folge Feedback habt, wenn ihr generell Fragen habt oder zum Beispiel Wünsche für andere Länder, dann könnt ihr mich wie immer kontaktieren über kontakt@globalvillage069.de oder über Instagram unter globalvillage069. Und wenn euch die Folge gefallen hat, dann teilt sie sehr gerne, abonniert den Podcast und wenn ihr mögt, lasst mir super, super gerne eine 5-Sterne-Bewertung da. Das hilft nämlich sehr dabei, dass auch andere auf Global Village 069 aufmerksam werden. Okay, fast genug gebabbelt. Bevor wir von Jeffrey hören, kommt hier
der Ländersteckbrief.
Vereinigte Staaten von Amerika.
Einwohnerzahl
334 Millionen.
Landessprache.
Hier gibt es eine Überraschung, zumindest war es für mich eine. Eine Amtssprache, die für die gesamten USA gelten würde, gibt es nämlich nicht. Allerdings ist Englisch die Verkehrssprache und auch die meistgesprochene Sprache. Und Englisch ist auch immerhin in 32 der 50 Bundesstaaten dann doch als Amtssprache festgelegt. Weitere lokale Amtssprachen sind zum Beispiel Hawaiianisch auf Hawaii oder Sioux in South Dakota. Und abgesehen von den festgelegten Amtssprachen spielen im Alltag von Millionen US-AmerikanerInnen noch andere Sprachen die wichtigste Rolle, zum Beispiel Spanisch, Chinesisch oder das philippinische Tagalog.
Hauptstadt
ist Washington D.C. Dort wohnen im US-amerikanischen Vergleich recht wenige Menschen, nur knapp 690.000. Damit ist Washington D.C. mehr als 10-mal kleiner als die größte US-Stadt, das ist nämlich New York City. Das D.C. steht übrigens für District of Columbia und hilft dabei, die Stadt Washington vom Bundesstaat Washington zu unterscheiden. Der liegt nämlich am komplett anderen Ende des Landes im alleräußersten Nordwesten.
Gut zu wissen.
Ja, warum ist Frankfurt eigentlich so geprägt von den USA? Das hat natürlich sehr viel damit zu tun, dass nach dem Zweiten Weltkrieg amerikanische Soldaten über lange Zeit hier stationiert waren. Zeitweise waren es bis zu 23.000. Angefangen hat die Beziehung zwischen Frankfurt und den Vereinigten Staaten aber schon viel früher, nämlich vor über 200 Jahren. Unsere Stadt war damals schon ein attraktiver Handelsstandort und hat damit viele US-amerikanische Unternehmen angezogen. Und so gibt es auch schon seit 1829 einen US-Konsul hier und das Frankfurter US-Konsulat ist das größte weltweit.
Das Sprichwort.
One phrase that I'm always using is that which does not kill you makes you stronger. Often when someone's talking about work or life going bad and I said, you know, that which does not kill you makes you stronger. Oh yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's what I would put out.
Entfernung von Frankfurt.
Luftlinie sind es 6531 Kilometer bis nach Washington D.C.
Unterwegs in Frankfurt
sind laut Statistik 2991 Menschen mit US-amerikanischer Staatsangehörigkeit. Und jetzt viel Spaß beim Gespräch. Welcome to Global Village 069, Jeffrey Carter. Hi.
Hey, thanks for doing this.
Well, thank you for doing this. I mean, the way we met is quite remarkable because we met in front of the Brasserie du Sud on Oppenheimer Landstraße.
Exactly.
Where I went to take a picture with Caroline Villot for the interview about France and Frankfurt. Mm-hmm. You kindly took the picture and we got chatting and here we are.
Yeah. And then we did a run through and after 2.5 hours of talking about things, you got an idea of where you wanted to go. And so here we are, giving it a go.
That's right. That's right. And we're sitting in the most wonderful place. We're sitting in your apartment. And it's a pity that podcasting is an audio medium. You know, people can't really see where we are. Can you give like a small description of your apartment? Because we're surrounded by beautiful things.
Well, my apartment, I have no free wall space anymore because every time I buy something, depending, I'll either swap something out or whatever. But it's filled with artwork from friends of mine from Frankfurt, Dusseldorf, Russia, all over the place, Paris, and Wiesbaden here. But yeah, I run into somebody I like. We talk. We say, "What do you do?" And they show me something. I said, "Oh, I'd like that one." In fact, I met a guy at Atavola, and yeah, we just got to chatting, and he said he was a photographer. I gave him my card, and I said, "Check out my website, which is jeffreycarter.de. So if you go there, you'll be able to see, for the most part, it's up to date." And so we exchanged cards. He gave me his card, and he's connected to some gallery, which I went online to look at. It's like super fancy. So, you know, I'm going, "Whoa, okay. So you all pick up the cost on everything?" But no, I do have my own show coming up in March. So yeah, I haven't shown at Gallery Tech Store 74 for a little over a year now because of COVID and whatnot. So I have, my house is like stacked full of canvases. I finished maybe 30 or more waiting for a new show, and then I'll bring some of my older things out and just leave them against the wall or something. So I'm looking forward to that, but you know, it's this will be the fifth show I've done there. And that gallery is run by Trixie Moan, who's also an artist. So my house, yeah, when people who haven't been here before come in here, they think it looks like a gallery. Well, it does, because there's so many different things in here, but yeah. And so I'm surrounded by my art, their art. The atmosphere here is very conducive to creativity. And there are some children from friends of mine who have come here, and I've given them some art lessons, and they sort of try to emulate what I'm doing, and then they do their own thing. My granddaughter wants to start painting again, but she has a new job, so she doesn't really have time for it. I'll make sure she does. And let's see.
It really is like a gallery. I was, because you were kind enough to give me a tour, and there's so many different styles and so many different stories behind every painting and every piece of art, and like also a lot of like pictures from families and friends. So it feels like your life story in art almost.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's very eclectic for sure.
Yeah.
But everything, for the most part, every art that I have, I know the artist personally.
Yeah, there's a personal connection.
Yeah.
And could you describe your style of painting in particular for the pieces that you will be showing at Texture 74?
Yes. I am influenced a lot by colors, design, because my degree, I'm a diploma graphica from the University of Maryland. So a lot of my stuff is graphic in nature. But if you go to my website, you'll see that I've branched off a little bit here and there with figures and whatnot. So yeah, who influences me? I was just looking around thinking this morning, and I was saying, well, that's a lot like Vasarely, but the colors are a lot like Modigliani. But then my great uncle is Alexander Calder, who does mobiles. And so he does a lot of just primary colors. So abstract expressionism with a heavy graphic style, painted in acrylic on canvas, and sometimes if I don't have a canvas, I'll paint it whatever is there. and like at the Brasserie de Sud is a good example. If you've seen those boxes out front, if I find a local artist and I say, "Hey, here's a box, paint it, and we'll put it out here."
I had no idea, because I walk by the Brasserie de Sud on a daily basis pretty much. And I had no idea that the boxes are, like, that's you behind it.
First I asked him, I said, "Hey, can I paint a box and put it out and you can put glasses on?"
Yeah.
"Oh yeah, great idea." So then I did a second one. And then my buddy Martin Held, he did one that's more like a abstract Union Jack.
Yes. Yeah.
And then there's another one that was done by a local artist, and I think it's Heike. but I forget her last name, but she lives just a couple blocks away. So what I want to do, or my idea was originally, to give a space for local artists to do their thing and be shown, and because a lot of them haven't shown before. Mm-hmm. And so I have one more box to do, and I'll find somebody.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure it will be an amazing box. I'm looking forward to seeing it outside Brasserie de Sud. So this is actually already answering the question, where else people can see your art outside of Textor 74. You've got your amazing website, which I really recommend people check out, because a lot of your work is on display there. And then Brasserie de Sud, so that's
great. Across the street, Section d'Arte Grad, that's it.
Yes, yeah.
I did a show there and had my paintings up for about 6 months, but the owner, Fotis, he swaps out for other artists. So yeah. There's someone in there now. And then at the Atavola, the pizza place,
yeah,
I put up a show there for about 2 months or so. And then on the corner, you get the Belladonna, an Italian restaurant.
Yeah.
And they're big fans, and they will show, anytime I do a show, if they have space, they put up a painting or two, but for sure they will always put up a poster. So that's one place you can go and see when it is. Sorry, I don't remember the exact date. It's like the second or third week in March.
I will. We will share the dates in the show notes and on the website as well. So, because this is airing in January, so
okay.
I will add that for sure. And I'm very much looking forward to the opening. It's going to be really good.
It'll be fun.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, in the past, what I've done is next door is Goodfellows.
Yes.
And I have them prepare trays of canapes or, you know, small stuff to eat. Mm-hmm. And I bring wine, and so there's turns into more of a party than, you know, but it's always nice.
A good opening is a party. You cannot have an opening without, you know, the fun and the wine.
Exactly. And so you got to come to the opening.
I will definitely be at the opening. I love art show openings and gallery openings, because my husband's got a degree in history of art. So we've always enjoyed that quite a lot when we were living in Berlin and then London and also now in Frankfurt. So
great.
Yeah, so that it's a date for sure. And can you talk, I know we'll talk about your biography a bit more in a short while, but can you just talk about how you started painting and when you started painting?
Well, I started doing a lot of graphics and freelance work for commercial agencies. In fact, one of my early jobs while I was in college was doing things for the Sears and Roebuck catalogs. I mean, real easy stuff, but it paid. And then when I graduated, I started up with the Holistic Design Guild. Some artist friends of mine, we kind of got together and we organized a guild, an artist craftsman guild. And one of the places we started was down in 16th and Rhode Island. And there was, used to be the Washington School of Law, I think it was. But then someone bought the whole thing out and was letting us, not squat, we had to pay a little money, but very little. So I started still doing graphics there, but then there was a space not being used, and so I opened up a gallery for the local artists that were there. And so I spent some time curating the gallery space, which was fun.
And this is in Washington, D.C., right? Because
yeah.
You're from Maryland, but then you moved to Washington, D.C. too.
Yeah.
Yeah, excellent.
So after I finished that, in 1980, I decided to do something different. So I went off to Los Angeles where I was acting. I was acting first off in soap operas with just walk-ons, and then it was under fives, and then it was a little bit more than that. And so I did that for 5 years, uh-huh. which was very nice. And then I decided, okay, 5 years is up, time for a change. So I joined the Army, and I won't tell you, well, I could tell you. I think I was 34 years old when I joined the Army, which freaked everyone out because, you know, I go there with all the 19-year-old recruits, and then here comes, you know, the daddy figure.
Yeah.
And, yeah, they were all the drill sergeants thought I was undercover for CID.
What's CID? Sorry.
The Criminal Investigation Division.
All right.
They thought I was, you know, trying to find something wrong. And, but, no, I wasn't. I was just, you know, I joined as a cavalry scout. And because I was mature, mm-hmm. they gave me a single room. And I was in charge of 40 soldiers in basic training. And each room had 10 soldiers in it. So I picked out 4 of the smartest guys in each room and made them in charge of the room. And so the yeah. 4 guys, instead of 40, just came to me and told me what's going on or what needed. And so I enjoyed that. And then basic training was over and they said, where do you want to go? And I said, well, I haven't been to Europe. How about Germany? And they said, sure. So off I go, flying to Germany. I land in Frankfurt. And I looked around and I said, whoa, this is kind of nice. Oh, no, you have to get on the bus. Oh, okay. So we got on a bus, or I did, and it drove to Nuremberg. And I said, well, this is still cool, a little quaint, more quaint, but it's all right. Back on the bus, Jeffrey. What? So I got on the bus, and the bus took me to Amberg in the Oberpfalz. And I was with the cavalry. And as soon as I got there, again, the same thing. What's this old dude doing here? And so they put me in the S2, and I was in charge of, quiet stuff. And then after about 3 months, I guess it was, the command sergeant major from Nuremberg, the cavalry from the 2nd ACR, he came there, and he was talking to all the soldiers, and I got his name and everything, so I sent him a note directly, not knowing protocol. And then about a month or 6 weeks later, I get called into the sergeant major's office in Amberg. And he wanted to dress me down, you know. But I said, well, I didn't know the rules, you know. He was talking about this and that. And I said, sounds good. I can do that. And so it turns out that I was chosen to be the voice of the cavalry from 85 to 90, and I was known as Corporal Cav, mm-hmm. and I had a DJ show, and I just played music all day. I did interviews and news and whatnot. I said, this is great. This isn't the Army, you know, but this is great. So I did that 5 years, and then when I couldn't get promoted because I was an E5 at the time. And so I said, okay, you know, I'll go into the reserve. So I went into the Army Reserve, the 7th Army Reserve Command, and they put me in public affairs. Mm-hmm. And so I was doing what I've been doing all along. And then eventually I was made an E6, and I was in charge of public affairs. And then in the reserve, you have a chance of promotion quickly, faster. So then I made E7, then I made E8. But when I first went to the reserve, first thing out of active duty to reserve, I went off to Desert Storm mm-hmm. as just a soldier, an infantryman. Mm-hmm. And then came back from that after about 9 months. The next thing up was Bosnia-Herzegovina, where I was there for a year doing stories and publishing a newspaper magazine. Then that was over, and then along comes, became a master sergeant, and I got sent to Afghanistan. And so I was running the press center as a master sergeant, and it was very cool because all the CNN and Reuters, yeah, and some of the others, BBC. So all those guys hung out in my building, mm-hmm. and that was fun. I mean, you know, a lot of journalists that go to war zones, they believe that if it bleeds, it leads. But I wasn't into that. There were so many good things going on down there. Roads being built, schools for women, things like that. So we did stories on that. And then after a year, I came back. And I came back a month early because my wife was sick. She had to have an operation. And so after she had the operation, then I went back to Vicenza, Italy, where I out-processed. Took another month. And then I came back and I started working for the Army Marketing. And I worked in different places, like starting in Nuremberg, then Grafenwöhr, then Vilsack, everywhere. Ended up being the marketing chief in Hanau, which I was the chief for about 8 years. And during that time, I got sent off to Afghanistan. And so I took one of the people from my office and put them in charge while I was gone. But I was gone 1 year in Afghanistan and really 3 months before and 3 months after. So I was gone quite some time. So when I came back, the person I put in charge wanted her own office. Mm-hmm. So, okay, bummer. She went off and took another job. And then Hanau closed and moved everyone to Wiesbaden. But I wasn't moved to Wiesbaden, everyone else but me, because the guy in charge of the Wiesbaden MWR didn't really like me.
Yeah.
And so I said, fine. So I then got a promotion down to Ansbach, where I worked for about a year and a half. And then I was approached by USAA because they needed a military affairs sales or rep, not mm-hmm. sales, but just a rep. And they were only taking sergeant majors, which I was at that time. And so I worked for USAA for Europe, the Army in Europe. And my buddy of mine took care of the Navy and Air Force, Mike Hurley. Mm-hmm. Nice guy, super nice. He's still with the company.
Excellent.
But they wanted you after 5 years to go back to the States. My wife, Monica, didn't want to move to the States. She goes, no, I'm not going to the States. If you want to take the job, go ahead, but I'm staying right here. Mm-hmm. I said, well, So I got back to USAA and I said, you know, I really appreciate you wanting to hold on to me, but they wanted to send me to St. Louis, Missouri, mm-hmm. which wasn't top of my list, you know. So after 6 weeks or 2 months of them trying to woo me to go there, I said, no, thanks. So I retired from USAA and then I came back here. And by that time, I had retired from the Army Reserve, from the government service, and USAA. And so I said, okay, time to do something. So that's when I started painting in earnest, which has now been about 9-10 years. And, you know, I keep myself busy painting, showing, enjoying that. And, yeah.
Can you briefly just say what is USAA?
United States Automobile Association.
Got it.
So it's an insurance company, a banking, investment, blah, blah, blah. But predominantly it's open to military.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
Best job ever. Super nice people. They cared about soldiers and family members. They took care of you financially well. And so I kept with that for 5 years, like I said, and then they wanted me to go back to the States, and so I stopped.
Yeah, for sure. Because you've been in Frankfurt for how long now? For many years.
I came here, was it 1989 or 98? It's one of those things, but yeah, I've been there, and always in Sachsenhausen.
Yeah.
So we moved three times, first on Gartenstrasse, then Eschenbachstrasse, and then Holbeinstrasse, where I am now. And I plan to stay here on infinitum.
Which is amazing. And I feel like you're so well connected, clearly, especially within this area. You know, with you having, you know, your work showing at the gallery, but then also Brasserie du Sud and a Tavola and Belladonna, and like, you really are a proper Sachsenhausener now.
Well, yeah, a lot of people think that I'm the unofficial mayor of Sachsenhausen. And so my friends, they say, yeah, he is, he knows everybody. But no, this is a really great corner to live in. This is really the artist corner. There's a lot of artists here, writers here, musicians. So this is really nice. I've been trying to find an atelier where I could maybe take some of the paintings out of my rooms. But right now I'm okay.
Yeah. There's just about, there's some space left here to stack up a few more canvases, just about. I mean, we've been talking about how you came to Frankfurt and when that was. When you first came here, or still till this day, is there a special connection with the American community or not so much?
Not so much, but I belong to the Wiesbaden Sergeant Majors Association, and I've been the president of that for maybe 8 years. And so I keep my finger on the pulse of the community and the army and, the association's all sergeant majors. So, you know, it's very easy, except that when we have meetings, they're all in their uniform and I'm in my civilian clothes, but they still, you know, they keep calling me sir. And I go, oh, okay, well, all right, fine. I'm older.
Yeah. You just roll with it.
Oh, yeah, sure. I don't care. I mean, when I run into Americans or English-speaking people, we strike up conversations, and some of them I continue to see. But yeah, I don't associate with Americans because I'm here in Germany, and I've learned the culture and pretty much the language. Maybe not great, but enough. And there's no reason to try and infuse America here in Germany. Except for yesterday's NFL game.
I was going to say, I was wondering if this is something that you're into or if this excites you because people are going crazy for the NFL.
Yeah,
in Frankfurt. Yeah.
Back in the States, yeah, sure, I follow the NFL. But
yeah.
Now that I'm here in Frankfurt, you know, I'm a fan of Eintracht.
So, excellent.
So then I was at the Gemalte House where they have a big screen. And so when Eintracht is on, me and a couple of my buddies, we all go there and we watch the game and scream and yell and jump up and down. And without having to pay the exorbitant price of the arena.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But I understand. I didn't even follow it until this morning. And I noticed that Kansas City did win.
They did.
But Swifties. Man, Kelsey, yeah. He didn't play so well, and they were all writing, saying his good luck charm wasn't at the game.
That's the reason. Has to be. I mean, I'm amazed at how much coverage the rumor got, whether Taylor Swift was going to come or not.
Right.
I mean, that got so much coverage. It was, I was quite baffled by it. But, you know, maybe if she had been there, he might have played better. But they won anyway, so...
Yeah, luckily, yeah.
Yeah, can you imagine?
But, I think she started a tour or something recently.
Yes, yeah. Small tour.
Yeah.
Small, like, there's the documentary showing at cinemas at the moment. It's quite remarkable, the level of success, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, good for
I follow football, but as Americans say, soccer.
Yes, excellent. There's one story that you told me when we had our like pre-conversation about you meeting Tony, I think it was. And I love that because you might have known one another when you were younger, but then you actually met here in Sachsenhausen. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. It turned out I was at Tavola having lunch with my wife, and then I heard somebody talking behind me in American English. And so I chatted him up, we started talking, and it turns out that he and I went to the same high school. I was 2 years ahead of him, but we knew all the same people. We went to all the same venues, and we were both friends with Nils Lofgren, who's now with the E Street Band. And so Nils was offered a slot with the Rolling Stones. But he decided to go with Bruce Springsteen because he goes, you know, I don't understand the English humor, but I know Bruce's humor. So, so he's been with Bruce for a long time now. And he just cut a new album, a solo album. So at any rate, but I met Tony through that, and you know, we're best of friends now, and he's part of the clique, and he represents companies in America that want to get into NATO. So he's traveling around here and doing all that and very happy with that. And when he's free, we're hanging out.
Excellent. But that hilarious that you didn't meet properly in high school. And then all these years later, you meet at A Tavola.
Yeah.
In Sachsenhausen, which is, I mean, it was meant to be. And I actually do want to come back to some of your adventures in LA to start with, because because you said you worked as an actor, which is super intriguing to me, or to anyone really. There's these two anecdotes that you mentioned when we spoke previously about you dressing up as a UPS driver and the fortune cookie.
Oh yeah.
Could you tell us A, about the UPS driver, and then about the fortune cookie idea that you had?
Well, when you get to LA and you don't have a manager, an agent, or anything, you have to be clever. And so I just used my marketing skills, and I got a UPS costume and put a big box together. But inside the big box was my headshot, and inside was also a fortune cookie. When you opened it up, it says, "Jeffrey Carter is coming into your life." And so I got past the guards, went up to the casting director. His secretary was the gatekeeper. And I said, "Don't need to see him, but here, this is for him." And then I walked away. And then she gave it to him. And the next day I get a phone call, and he wants me to come in so he can talk to me. So, of course, first I get a bunch of flowers and I give it to the secretary. And then I go in and have a talk with him. And he was the first one. Oh, no, he wasn't the first one. The first one to give me a shot was General Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked that for 2 weeks as a mercenary. Of course, when the storyline changed, I got killed. And then, so then I went on to Young and the Restless, and I had multiple roles in there. And at the time of going to Young and the Restless, this was when David Hasselhoff was leaving the show and Demi Moore was leaving the show. And so I did Young and the Restless for about a year, and then a new soap opened up across the hall called Capital.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'd been working steadily and the casting director knew me, I got cast as an Italian maitre d' on Capital. And so I was Alessandro.
Which is, so just to say, because you don't like come across as the typical Italian maitre d', you know, you've got, you know, like, because you were blonde back then?
Yeah,
dark blonde, blue eyes and all. I mean, there's Italians with, you know, blonde hair and blue eyes and stuff, but it's an interesting casting choice, I would say.
Well, that, along with the fact that I also own my own tuxedo. So that and the opportunity to be the maitre d' at this restaurant that got used at least twice a week.
Uh-huh.
So that was steady, that was good money. And then being an Italian maitre d' in an Italian restaurant, and then the storyline 9 months later, the Italians took it over, and I ended up being killed and dumped in the dumpster out back. And so I died a second time in Hollywood. And then, so I went over to NBC and was working Days of Our Lives. And because I'm, you know, this big Irish looking guy, they made me a cop. And so I worked with Roman and Abe, and I was always with them. But then Roman wanted to have a break from the show. So they wrote in for him to, there was an explosion, and, you know, we were all there. And, of course, he didn't get killed, but, of course, the big Irish cop got killed. So that was my third death in Hollywood. So I finished there. Then about 4 or 5 months later, there was a new show called Santa Barbara. And the casting director for Days of Our Lives knew me. And she gave me a shot and gave me a reoccurring role under 5 lines. So you made good money. And but I didn't have a manager and agent yet. So it's really hard to land a contract unless you have someone like that.
Sure.
But so I was doing all that, and I worked Capitol about 10 shows. And then there was some stuff that was going on, and I had a business manager that wasn't too cool. And so I hired a lawyer, and I broke that contract, which when the lawyer looked at it, he goes, "Who wrote this?" And I said, "I think my manager." And it was like indentured servitude. So broke that contract. And then next thing I know, about a month later, I get a knock on the door in my bungalow. And it's two Hell's Angels standing there. And they say, "You know, we heard you gave up on your business manager." I won't use names. "And you need to go back to work for him. Otherwise, the next time you see us, we're going to break your legs." And I thought, okay. So I said, "Hell's Angels, that's a pretty big gang." So I said, "I need a bigger gang." So I joined the Army because of that.
Jeez.
So I had a big gang.
You had the biggest gang.
And because of the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act, my business manager was trying to sue me, but he couldn't do it because I was in the Army.
Yeah.
And so I went through five years active Army and another 20 years reserve. Mm. And then when I left the reserve, I was open season on Jeffrey.
Yeah. Until today.
But I never heard from him again. And
One thing I was wondering is, because you went from having this very, you know, artistic free existence with a lot of very memorable anecdotes to joining the Army, and like in my head that's a very big, well, not contradiction, but a very, very different lifestyle. Was how did you adjust, or did you find that very difficult?
Well, I guess I'm an all-American boy. I wanted to serve in the military, and it seemed like a great opportunity and protection anyway. So I joined at 34 and loved it. I mean, I loved the discipline. I mean, I went into graphics because I like, you know, how things are laid out in graphics. And the military was very much like that.
But one thing that seems to kind of like be like a consistent theme in your life is that you're a storyteller. You're, you know, telling stories visually. When you joined the Army, even there, you were in charge of marketing, public relations. So this is something that I find quite remarkable, like with all the differences in your biography, that seems to be like a common theme.
It is. I mean, I tried to keep my hopscotching, my moves, because of my graphic experience, my public affairs experience, and all the rest of that. It seemed logical. So yeah, I did all right. I made a lot of friends along the way. I still have those friends, and I've made new friends here in Sachsenhausen. And it's so funny because I'll be at the Brasserie du Sud, and having, after I go to the gym, the Primetime Fitness I now belong to.
Yes.
And then after I finish there, I go across to the Brasserie du Sud because I heard that Arnold Schwarzenegger always had a Weizen beer after his workout. And so I'd go over to the Brasserie and have a Weizen, and then I'd sit there and I'd talk to people, and people would walk by and I'd say, "Hey," and you know, people that know me a little bit, and then they're sitting there seeing all these people go by going, "Hey, Jeffrey, hello."
Yes.
So that sort of brought on that unofficial mayor of Sachsenhausen.
I mean, I can attest to that. When we had our conversation sitting outside Brasserie du Sud, everyone seems to know you. So
that can be good and bad. "Jeffrey, I saw you." Oh. Was I behaving?
So you have traveled extensively in the US with the military, and you know several German places as well, because you were talking about your time in Nuremberg and Ansbach and Hanau. How does Frankfurt differ? Like, what makes Frankfurt? Because you say, you know, you're here, you've been here for many years, and you're here to stay.
Yeah, we lived in Nuremberg during my AFN time, and then afterwards during my reserve time. And Nuremberg is great. Beautiful, beautiful city there. Chris Kindlemark was world famous.
Gorgeous, yeah.
And so you had to get used to drinking Weizen and Nuremberger Bratwurst,
yes,
which was fine. And then I got promoted up to Hanau as the marketing chief, and my wife and I took a place in Sachsenhausen, and it was so like a small village. You know, you look across and you see the high rises, but Sachsenhausen is really a small village, and the people were so friendly once you settled in. And so Sachsenhausen is nice. Now, my wife came from Dusseldorf, which is up north. And when we first moved to Nuremberg, that was a bit of a culture shock for her, because Nuremberg is not the same as Frankfurt, which she adapted to better. Mm-hmm. But we would always go and visit friends in Dusseldorf, and yeah, I knew a lot of artists up there and whatnot. So Sachsenhausen, I always compare it, if coming from Washington, D.C., where my family is around, old Georgetown reminded me, or Sachsenhausen reminded me of old Georgetown, the old buildings, the small mom and pop stores and whatnot. And so I felt really comfortable and at home here. And I tried to go to all the different restaurants. On a given week, I would eat at 5 different restaurants. Sunday, six days a week. Sunday, I would stay at home. I'd cook. You know, Sunday was always a chill day.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So, as it's supposed to be. Yeah.
So, yeah, no. Love Sachsenhausen.
So if you want to kind of feel like you're traveling to the US, but I don't know, don't have the means, don't have the time, whatever, just one, your tip is just wander around Sachsenhausen, pretend you're in old Georgetown. Is that?
Yeah. I mean, I used to travel 2, sometimes 3 times a year back to the States. Mm-hmm. And then I stopped doing that about a while ago. And 10 years, yeah, when I started painting. Then the current political scene in the past was not my cup of tea. Mm-hmm. And then you had all these open carry and guns. Everyone has guns. And then idiots go and shoot up schools and kids and everything. I just didn't want to have anything to do with that. And I wish politics or politicians would finally get around to making some rules up to stop that, you know?
Yeah.
So people say, don't you want to move back to Washington or to D.C. or the U.S.? And I said, nope. I'm so entrenched here in Sachsenhausen. And yeah, it's been a while since my wife passed, but the building here and the artwork and everything is her spirit still here. So why leave? I'm never going to leave her spirit. In fact, she's resting in the Südbahnhof. Or Südbahnhof, Südfriedhof, yeah. And so I booked a plot right next to her.
Right.
So.
Right.
And then I have my daughter and her husband here. My granddaughter is here. My grandson is back in North Carolina. But my German family is equally big. I have 3 sisters back in the States, and I'm very close to my sister who's 1 year older.
Nice.
So yeah, Janet is back in the States looking after my other 2 sisters and her family, their families. Mm-hmm. And yeah, my parents passed when they were both 95. So yeah, it's been 5 years since then.
Oh,
I think.
Wow.
So yeah, I'm here to stay.
Yeah, wonderful. First of all, I'm very sorry for your losses about Monica and your parents as well.
We all are born to die.
That's right. But it feels like it's so wonderful to see you thrive here, having your network here, having your family here, but then not just your biological family, but also it feels like, you know, your clique in Sachsenhausen, the whole neighborhood seems like family to you.
It is. I mean, I know at least half the people on the street here, and when they're walking by and I'm out, everyone says hello. So it's not typical for Germans to say hello to people walking by, not typically. Mm. But, well, it's all good.
Do you find find that the, because you struck me as somebody who's very, you know, extrovert, very eager to connect and very good at that, and very upbeat in terms of your temperament.
Yeah.
Do you find, is that something that you think is typically American, or do you think your American background has helped you there?
It's not really an American thing, but they do, even if they don't know you, they'll say hello on the street.
Yeah.
But they have their own little cliques. I mean, if you're not part of a clique or a political party or whatever, they're not part of your thing.
Mm.
So
it's more of a Jeffrey Carter thing. It's not an American thing, it's a Jeffrey Carter thing to be connecting to everybody.
This is true, and that's probably why I did so well in radio and public speaking and journalism and everything. I mean, yeah. Everything was in line with what I did. So, yeah, it was real easy because in the Army Reserve, I was always tapped to be the narrator at all the events. And so the generals in charge of everything gave me a moniker of the voice. And so, you know, I'd walk down and the general, hey, voice, come here a second. And if the generals didn't speak well in front of the mic, I would give them lessons and whatnot. So it all worked out fine. And yeah, the voice.
But you are, this is where it's great that we're on a podcast that, you know, people can hear your voice, and it's really very impressive and very, I don't know, quite soothing and calming, I find. But
thank you.
You're welcome. But also, one thing that strikes me is you mentioned that you, you know, you were teaching people in power who struggle speaking publicly, mm-hmm. and now you're also teaching the younger generation to paint, right? So is this something that matters to you as well, teaching and passing on your knowledge?
Exactly. You know, if you're not trying to help someone else out, you're not helping yourself out.
That's wonderful. I feel like if there is ever an election, an actual election for the mayor of Sachsenhausen, surely you'll have my vote.
Thank you. I like being unofficial because then I don't have to go to boring functions. I can continue going to all the art openings and the music concerts and whatnot. Yeah, so. But the small talk, I'm not big on small talk.
No.
Hi, how's the weather? Shut up.
Oh, excellent. Well, I think Sachsenhausen is definitely a lot better off for you being here and producing so much beautiful work. I'm very excited for the opening.
Good.
I'm very excited to be seeing you around a lot at Atavo Lab, Rasserie du Sud, Belladonna, wherever, on the street, of course. And thank you very much for this conversation.
You're welcome. I had a great time. And, you know, I'm kind of sitting here talking about everything. And I'm going, oh, yeah, I did do that. What? You know, I'm going, oh, my God, I can't wait until I listen to this. And I go, oh, did I say that? I hope I didn't make a mistake.
No, not at all. It was perfect. And someday somebody needs to write your biography as well. So that needs to happen.
Actually, I toy with that idea, maybe looking for a ghostwriter or something.
Excellent. Okay, let's keep talking off mic then. Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
Welcome, and thank you for having me.